الإنسان. For example, in Muhjam Ahadith al-Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam, volume 3, page 23, and of course this is another Mursal narration, Yaqdud Durar, page 72, section 4, chapter 2, and also At-Tashrif al-Minan, chapter 74, hadith number 417. These are some of the sources who have mentioned that Sufyani is from the lineage of Abu Sufyan. Okay. And the fourth narration is the narration that calls him a person from the lineage of Aqilatul Akbat. That is, the woman who ate the liver of Hamza, the uncle of the Prophet, that is, Hind, the wife of Abu Sufyan. The narration is mentioned in Al-Ghiba by Nu'mani, page 317, chapter 18, hadith number 16. This narration is, of course, weak because of a certain Ubaidullah bin Musa in the chain of the narration. In another narration, Imam Ali alayhi salam says, يَخْرُجُ إِبْنُ أَكِلَةِ الْأَكْبَاتِ مِنَ الْوَادِ الْيَابِسِ. Ibn Akilat al-Akbat, the son of Akilat al-Akbat, that is Sufyani, will come from the dry land. This is in Kamaluddin, chapter 57, hadith number 9. Again, this narration is weak because of a certain Muhammad ibn Ali al-Kufi in the chain.
Sure. We'll discuss more after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us. Welcome back. You're listening to The Last Savior. We are with Dr. Karimi, and Dr. Karimi has been discussing a couple of narrations which talk about Sufyani, like why he is, about his lineage, basically. We were Dr. Karimi, and we're talking about the lineage of Sufyani. Dr. Karimi discussed a couple of narrations here, and Dr. Karimi, do we have more narrations, or?
As I mentioned, there are four groups of the narrations. According to the first group, he is from Quraysh.
He's from Quraysh.
According to the second, from Banu Umayyah. Yeah. According to the third, from Abu Sufyan. And according to the fourth, he is from Hind, the wife of Abu Sufyan. Of course, these narrations, although apparently they are referring to different lineages, but the point is that all of them, I mean, they are contradicting each other. They may refer to the same truth because Abu Sufyan is from Quraysh and is from Banu Umayyah. And Aqilatul Akbat is his wife, I mean, Hind.
Okay.
So all these narrations are referring to the fact that Sufyani is from Abu Sufyan and Hind.
Yeah.
He is one of the offspring of this couple, and of course these people are from
Quraysh.
You're trying
to say that apparently these narrations do contradict with each other, but when we see and have a deep look at them, he is from Abu Sufyan and Hind.
Exactly. Now, this is based on the narrations without analyzing the chain.
Yeah.
Now we want to answer this question, what is the lineage of Sufyani, based on authentic narrations.
Okay.
The point is that a couple of the narrations that I shared, they were quoted just by Sunni sources, and we cannot refer to them as authentic sources and authentic narrations, like the narrations from Iqdud Durar or At-Tashrif bil-Minan. There are only three narrations that we quoted from Shia sources. The chain of all these three narrations are weak.
Yeah.
Now, this is one point. So we do not have even one authentic narration that talk about the lineage of Sufyani. This is one point. The second point is that in the past, in the history of Islam, we have had some people from the lineage of Abu Sufyan, I mean from his offsprings, who have claimed that they are the promised Sufyani, or other people, they have called them as the promised Sufyani. So according to some scholars, it might be that the same people have forged some narrations to claim that Sufyani is from Abu Sufyan, just to prove that they are the promised Sufyani, or other people have claimed that these are the promised Sufyani. So that is why they may have tried to, I mean, deceive a group of people, for example, the enemies of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. So the conclusion of all these points is that When it comes to the lineage of Abu Sufyan, at least we cannot say that for sure his lineage goes back to Abu Sufyan. And this point is not mentioned in authentic sources. And he might be called Sufyani because of the fact that, as I mentioned, his feature is like that of Abu Sufyan. He mm-hmm. is opposing the truth. Like Abu Sufyan, who for many years was one of the main enemies of the Prophet, he was opposing the Prophet even after apparently he converted to the religion of Islam, but he continued to
oppose him.
Exactly, oppose him, and even after the demise of the Prophet.
Yeah.
So the same is true about Sufyani at the time of the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. He will do his best to oppose Imam Mahdi alayhi salam and to defeat him. And that is why this is, of course, at least a possibility that he is called Sufyani, because he is like Abu Sufyan.
Okay.
But is he from the same lineage? At least we cannot say that this is something for sure. No, we do not have any authentic narration talking proof. About this point. But again, I try my point that people will not have any problem in realizing Sufyani. And we are not in need of knowing the lineage because of the fact that we will know Sufyani through the actions that he will do
mm-hmm.
and through the other signs which are mentioned to be happening at the same time, like that of Yamani
yeah.
and Khorasan.
Yeah, so thank you so much, Dr. Karimi. We came to the conclusion that it's not very important what is his name or what is his lineage, but it's for sure that yes, his features are like that of Abu Sufyan. So maybe we could say to some extent that he's from the lineage of Abu Sufyan, but not very surely. We're not very sure about the fact. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you so much for providing us so much information that I have been always making notes of your sayings and saving them. And my friends are also doing that. Thank you so much for providing us with that important knowledge about the Imam of the time, which is neat. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In Britain, nurses are set for their second major period of industrial action, while industrial action is also set to escalate in other sectors as well. The British government, however, is gearing up to introduce new anti-strike legislation. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. A wave of further teaching, ambulance and civil service strikes is likely to move forward this week as nurses are set for their second major period of industrial action. While ministers signalled a new deal may be close with the rail unions, strikes look set to escalate in other sectors as ministers geared up to introduce controversial new anti-strike legislation to the House of Commons on Monday, 16th of January. Nurses from the Royal College of Nursing will strike on Wednesday, 18th and Thursday, 19th of January, with the union warning that more members in England will take action the next time in early February if there is no breakthrough by the end of the month. The Royal College of Nursing General Secretary Pat Cullen described the Prime Minister's position in their negotiation deadlock as baffling, reckless and politically ill-considered. Sources in the Department of Health said no talks were currently scheduled, but they were still hoping for more meetings after discussions broke down bitterly last week. Meanwhile, the National Education Union, NEU, and School Leaders Union, NAHT, are expected to announce the result of ballots for strikes over pay on Monday, 16th of January. Mary Booster, General Secretary of the National Education Union, NEU, told Times Radio she was confident, based on our own internal surveys of our membership, that we will reach the ballot threshold. But the only vote that counts is that reported by the independent polling company, and we'll know that just before we make the announcement to the members tomorrow afternoon. Also in the teaching sector, the Education Institute of Scotland, EIS, will stage a strike for 16 consecutive days until 2nd of February, which will see members in two local authorities strike each day. London bus workers and at Abellio are going to strike on Monday 16th of January and Wednesday 18th of January. Industrial tensions have also been inflamed by the government's proposed anti-strike bill, which will have its first reading in the House of Commons on Monday. The TUC, the Trades Union Congress, the coordinating body for trade unions, accused the government of being spiteful with the legislation and attempting to steamroller through new draconian new measures without proper consultation or scrutiny. The organisation said it would mean that when workers vote to strike in the healthcare sector, the education sector, the fire, transport, border security and nuclear decommissioning, they can be forced to work and sacked if they don't comply. Angela Rayner, Labour Party's deputy leader and shadow secretary for the future of work, called it a shoddy, unworkable bill that won't do a thing to help working people or avoid strikes. Labour will be opposing this assault on common sense that would see fundamental British freedoms ripped up in order to distract from the crisis the Tories have inflicted on our country, Angela Rayner said. The FDA Union of Senior Civil Servants will reveal the result of its ballot for a strike of the graduate fast stream early this week, and about 300 PCS union members in the court and tribunal service are set to strike on Saturday. GMB leaders will meet on Monday to decide whether to call more ambulance service strikes, with talks currently stalled. The website of UK Daily News has also covered the same story and tells us more. A wave of more strikes in the classroom, ambulances and public service sectors is likely to move forward this week as nurses brace for their second major industrial action in Britain. While ministers signalled a new deal with rail unions could be finalised, strikes in other sectors appear to be escalating as ministers prepare to table a controversial new anti-strike bill in the House of Commons on Monday, 16th of January. Nurses at the Royal College of Nursing will go on strike on Wednesday, 18th of January and Thursday, 19th of January, with a union warning other members in England will take industrial action in early February if there is no breakthrough by the end of the month. The Royal College of Nursing Secretary-General Pat Cullen described the Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's position in the deadlock as stunning, reckless and politically ill-considered. Sources in the Health Ministry said no talks were planned at the moment, but they were still hoping for more meetings after discussions bitterly collapsed last week. With so many strikes in the pipeline, the sector that appeared closest to the deal was rail. Mark Harper, the Transport Secretary, confirmed on Sunday, 15th of January that he had given a new mandate to operating companies to discuss pay alongside reforms with the rail unions, raising hopes of a breakthrough in the long-running dispute. Mark Harper, the Transport Secretary, told Sky News, "The train operating companies have got permission from me to make a new offer to rail unions. That is what they're going to be doing. That is what I was asked to do, and that is my role in the process." A new labour analysis also called into question the government's claim that similar anti-strike legislation has been effective in France and Spain. It found that in 3 years, France lost 8 times as many days to strikes and Spain 5 times as many days to strikes as the United Kingdom. And the analysis showed that in 2019, France lost 23 times more days to strikes than the United Kingdom, and Spain lost 6 times more days to strike than the UK. The Labour Party's deputy leader, Angela Rayner, added, "Ministers are desperately seeking to justify this legislation by using disingenuous comparisons with France and Spain. But this just won't wash, as both lose significantly more days to strike than the United Kingdom." The Trades Union Congress, the TUC, is coordinating a day of industrial action and strike on 1st of February in protest against the new anti-strike legislation.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the consequences of violation of chastity. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of the consequences of the violation of chastity in the Islamic lifestyle. We know that Islam gives importance to the chastity, to the modesty, and it gives respect to the women. And the respect which is given in the Islam to the women is the most beautiful respect that we can see in the world or in other religions. We can only find this respect in the religion of Islam. Islam talks about the protection of the woman. Therefore, when we talk about the family and the problems that occur in the family, it is necessary that the family members, either it's the husband or the wife, they both do not violate the chastity that they have. Because there is a level of chastity for man and there is a level of chastity for the woman. For the woman, obviously, she has to observe hijab. She should not socialize with na-mahram or non-mahram, the ones who are who she is not allowed to show her hairs to them. She should not talk freely to the strangers. And these are the levels of the chastity, different levels of the chastity that she has to observe. And if she observes the chastity, then obviously the man of the house or the husband feels secure. And when he feels secure, he provides more sustenance for the wife, and he will have a secure life with the wife, because he knows that the wife is not cheating. Today's problem is that when man thinks he thinks that the wife is basically cheating the man. And in the Western society, we can see these problems through the media, through the followers of the other religions, or those who are not Muslims. They have this issue in their houses. Therefore, it is necessary to observe the chastity, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of the consequences of violation of chastity. We said that the women should observe the chastity as well as the man should observe the chastity. Now, when we talk about the man or the husband, there is a level of chastity that he should not socialize with the non-mahram or the strangers. Even when he socializes with them, he should talk to them according to the necessity or the necessity which is there. And he should not talk more than what it has been described in Islam. He should not become so free or frank with the na-mahram, and he should lower his gaze when there is a na-mahram in front of him. He should always observe the chastity that is required in the Islam. Therefore, when he is socializing with the people, when obviously he has to socialize with the people, with the non-mahram, he should observe that level of chastity which is recommended by Islam. This way, the wife will feel security, and she will feel security when she is in the house. She will be trusting on the husband when the husband is out of the side or he's working outside. Therefore, it is necessary for both the husband and wife, for both, to observe the chastity. And if they violate the chastity, if they perform a violation in the chastity, then obviously the formation of family is disturbed. Then the family will not have peace in it. There will be always discussions, there will be always arguments between the husband and wife and the family member as well. And the trust which is necessary to be in the family, where both parties, like the husband and wife, should trust each other, this trust will no more be there if someone violates the chastity which must be observed according to the Islam. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
In the limelight.
Scientists are once again warned that by 2030, the emission of greenhouse gases should be reduced by half around the world in order to avoid the worst of climate change. They say the moving countries on the current dangerous path will add another 3 degrees Celsius to the current level of global warming, which is twice more than the threshold of 1.5 degrees Celsius that was set at the COP21 Paris Climate Summit. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Scientists have warned the return of El Niño climate phenomena later this year will cause global temperatures to rise off the chart and deliver unprecedented heat waves. Early forecasts suggest El Niño will return later in 2023, exacerbating extreme weather around the globe and making it very likely the world would exceed 1.5 degrees Celsius of global warming. The hottest year in recorded history, 2016, was driven by a major El Niño. It is part of a natural oscillation driven by ocean temperatures and winds in the Pacific Ocean, which switches between El Niño, its cooler counterpart La Niña, and neutral conditions. The last 3 years have seen an unusual run of consecutive La Niña events. This year is already forecast to be hotter than 2022, which global data sets rank as the fifth or sixth hottest year on record. But El Niño occurs during the Northern Hemisphere winter, and its heating effect takes months to be felt, meaning 2024 is much more likely to set a new global temperature record. The greenhouse gases emitted by human activities have driven up average global temperatures by about 1.2 degrees Celsius to date. This has already led to catastrophic impacts around the world, from searing heat waves in the United States and Europe to devastating floods in Pakistan and Nigeria, harming millions of people. Professor Adam Scaife, the head of long-range prediction at the UK Met Office, said the fluctuating impacts of the El Niño and La Niña cycle would be seen in many regions of the world. Professor Scaife added, "Science can now tell us when these things are coming months ahead, so we really do need to use it and be more prepared, from having readiness of emergency services right down to what crops to plant." While El Niño would supercharge extreme weather, the degree of exacerbation was under debate among scientists. Professor Bill Maguire of University College London said, "When El Niño arrives, the extreme weather that has rampaged across our planet in 2021 and 2022 will pale into insignificance." While Professor Tim Palmer of University of Oxford said, "The correlation between extreme weather and global mean temperatures is not that strong, but the thermodynamic effects of climate change are going to make the anomalies we get from an El Niño year just that much more extreme." Climate modelling results issued in early January by Australia's Bureau of Meteorology indicated the country could swing from 3 years of above-average rainfall to one of the hottest, driest El Niño periods on record, increasing the risk of severe heat waves, droughts and wildfires. In December, the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the NOAA, rated the odds of an El Niño forming by August to October as 66%. Turkey's Anadolu News Agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. Britain's Meteorological Office has forecast this year will be warmer than last year and one of the hottest on record. Predictions suggest it will be the 10th year in a row the global temperature is at least 1 degree Celsius above average. Scientific evidence shows that climate change is driving up global temperatures. In July, the United Kingdom recorded its hottest temperature ever, with the mercury hitting 40.2 degrees Celsius, that is 104.3 degrees Fahrenheit, at Heathrow Airport in West London. The heat wave also sparked bushfires in and around London, setting houses ablaze. Some countries across Europe had been struggling to put out wildfires and at times have been criticised by activists for not doing enough to combat the climate crisis and its effects. Although the general take is that the world is heading towards a warmer year, scientists are professionally cautious when asked how the coming summer will be. Meteorologist Andy Hill told Anadolu News Agency that it is not possible to give a confident forecast, but also cited a report by the American Meteorological Society, which points to changes in the monthly average to understand that 2023 will see the world entering an El Niño, a periodic event that involves above-average sea surface temperatures across East and Central Equatorial Pacific Ocean. The Met Office's Nick Dunstan, who has led the 2023 global temperature forecast, said, "The global temperature over the last 3 years has been influenced by the effect of a prolonged La Niña, where cooler than average sea surface temperatures occur in the tropical Pacific Ocean." Nick Dunstan added, "For the next year, our climate model is indicating an end to the 3 consecutive years with a La Niña state and a return to relatively warmer conditions in parts of the tropical Pacific Ocean. This shift is likely to lead to global temperatures in 2023 being warmer than 2022. Maximiliano Herrera, a meteorologist who focuses on climate data, agreed that the probability of warmer than average conditions occurring is greater for cooler conditions. According to data collected by Herrera, just this month, the warmest January day ever was recorded in at least 8 European countries, including Poland, Denmark, the Czech Republic, Netherlands, Belarus, Lithuania, and Latvia. The website of Business Insider India writes, "If you ever shared a common working space with someone, you know there's at least a 10-degree difference between setting the AC at 21 degrees C and 24 degrees C, even if science can't prove it. However, the effects of such excruciating yet minuscule change disappear once you leave the room, something that unfortunately cannot be said for global rising temperatures. What's worse is that the sheer scale of damage that global warming can inflict is incomparable for even the tiniest temperature increments. We stand to lose entire countries to sea level rise and immeasurable species to habitat destruction, with billions more getting exposed to tragedy if the 1.5 degrees Celsius Paris warning target is breached." And a new UK Met study shows that the spiral may begin from just next year. If you aren't familiar with El Niño and La Niña, they're basically extremely large-scale weather patterns in the Pacific Ocean that can disrupt worldwide weather and even affect marine life to a considerable extent. Both affect west-blowing trade winds along the equator, which help in moving warmer water from South America towards Asia. And the effect and position of this warm water butterflies into creating distinct weather phenomena all over the world. We've been experiencing La Niña conditions for the past 3 years, something that is due to change very, very soon. And this is concerning because La Niñas are generally associated with a temporary cooling effect on temperatures. That's right, the last 3 years were supposed to be among the cool ones. Thank you, global warming. Once the weather patterns oscillate back to El Niño, that is associated with warmer weather patterns, you best believe that sweater days might have to take a temporary back seat in some parts of the world over the next few years. For reference, El Niño year of 2016 was the hottest year on record since 1850, and also the year where the Great Barrier Reef faced the largest die-off event, again fueled by El Niño.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. To our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghodde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Men and women as human beings are completely equal in Islam. This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, meeting with hundreds of prominent Iranian women in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on January 4, 2023. Let's say you read one of the books that tells the story of one of the wives of the martyrs. I doubt you will be able to read one of these biographies without shedding tears while reading it. It is impossible. When one sees the struggles of such a woman, now the man has gone to the battlefield, but this woman is performing jihad. This jihad is obligatory on both of them. Enjoining good and forbidding evil is obligatory on both men and women. But roles have been divided. The roles are not the same. This is the view of Islam in the various fields that I have mentioned. It is both an advanced and just a view. A woman is in her exalted place and a man is in his distinguished place, both enjoying legal, intellectual, theoretical, and practical privileges contrary to West judgments, capitalist system. Of course, I'm referring to the modernized West, as I mentioned previously.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
و Western capitalism is a patriarchal system. So what they attribute to Islam, which is incorrect and is the opposite of the truth, exists in their own system. Why? This viewpoint stems from the fact that in the capitalism, capital is more important than humanity. Humanity is being used to serve capital. Whoever is able to generate and accumulate more capital is more valuable. Men are more aggressive. They are stronger. The extraction of gold, jewels, and diamonds, etc. from mines was carried out by men in Africa, in the US, and in South America. It is men who have been managing the economy, trade deals, and such. Therefore, men have priority over women in capitalism. Since capital is more in the hands of men, men have a higher priority. So now that capital is supposed to determine the status of people, people are no longer the same. Naturally, they are different. As I have already mentioned, according to the capitalistic view, the male gender is naturally superior to the female gender.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Gaza, the symbol of resistance. This is the title of the conference held in Tehran. Attended by Iranian officials and members of Palestinian resistance groups, the event seeks to shed light on Palestinian suffering under more than 7 decades of Israeli occupation, with Gaza bearing the title of an icon for the struggle for freedom.
Gaza, the 360 square kilometer, besieged over 17 years maybe, and with this dire situation, the people over there were managed to steadfast, to confront the continuous aggressions and offensive from the Israeli forces against our civilians, against our common people in Gaza.
The event is held on the anniversary of the 22-day resistance in the Gaza Strip in late 2008 and early 2009, where Palestinians resisted Israel's military offensive.
Today was the day that in Iran we remember the resistance of the Palestinian people in Gaza district after the invasion of the Israeli troops in 2008. On that year, the Israeli troops invaded oppressed people of the Palestinian in Gaza district. And in Iran, every year we remember that.
This year's edition of the annual conference seeks to recognize late Iranian General Qasem Soleimani's role in strengthening the resistance axis in Palestine.
When we talk about freedom, when we talk about resistance, when we talk about Palestine, you cannot miss the name of Shahid Soleimani. Shahid Soleimani is a big icon for us in Palestine and resistance movement to defend our own legitimate right. Shahid Soleimani was a big brother to us.
General Soleimani was killed along with his fellow comrades in January 2020 near Baghdad International Airport in a drone strike launched by the U.S. The Iranian military commander spearheaded major operations in Syria and Iraq that led to the defeat of Daesh and recapturing of key areas from the terror group.
People here say General Soleimani was a key element in the resistance front, who had plans to liberate Palestine from the Israeli occupation. They say this was a major reason why the U.S. assassinated him. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Former EU lawmaker Pierre Antonio Panzeri was among those arrested by Belgian police last month as part of a probe into a cash for favours scheme allegedly involving Qatar and Morocco. He has just signed a deal with prosecutors to name names in return for a reduced sentence. On Tuesday, during a debate in the European Parliament on the scandal, the EU itself was accused of corruptly targeting some of its own member states.
No peace without justice. Whose secretary has been arrested for corruption? This organization was financed by the EU, France and Germany. What a coincidence, because this very organization focused on attacking Poland.
Belgian police have recovered more than €1.5 million in cash following dozens of raids. So far, the scandal mainly involves members of the S&D political grouping in the European Parliament.
Since the accusations emerged in December, we in the Socialists and Democrats group have been working intensively to try and implement reforms to combat corruption. We have to ensure accountability, transparency and integrity.
Sitting Greek MEP Eva Kaili is among four currently behind bars awaiting trial. Lawmakers are demanding that an EU-wide ethics body is established. Aside from the Parliament scandal, each year millions of euro go unaccounted for from the EU budget. This as ordinary citizens struggle to make ends meet.
It's a serious source of concern, and we also see that there is very little progress made on poverty and social exclusion, which remains at very high level in the EU.
Some lawmakers say the EU is showing a great deal of hypocrisy, given that so much is said here about rule of law problems elsewhere. Sources tell us Belgian police will almost certainly be making more arrests in the coming days as part of the European Parliament corruption probe. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
For over a millennium, Florence, known as the cradle of Renaissance, has been a global icon of beauty, being the third largest tourist destination in Italy after Rome and Venice. Florence, a stunning, vibrant city with a storied and well-preserved history, attracts every year around 60 million tourists from across the world. However, starting from the last decade of the 20th century, its city centre has been eyed by big investment groups interested in making profits through the acquisition of local real estate assets. As a result, living costs in the oldest part of Florence went dramatically up, forcing a high number of residents to sell their apartments.
This situation has been going on for a number of years now. Florentines who used to live in the city centre found living costs unsustainable and opted to move to the suburbs. Their former houses have been rented to wealthy tourists, and investment companies have made billions in profits.
Throughout the years, smaller landlords in Florence have been aggressively targeted by large corporate investors. For those investors, housing has turned into a key factor for the management of global capital funds. As a result, the new housing market has led to excessively high rents, widespread displacement, as well as the dismantling of local communities and social bonds. A referendum called Let's Save Florence has been recently launched in the Tuscan city in an attempt to protect the citizens from the real estate bubble and the speculation which have distorted the local housing market. Many hundreds of residents have supported the initiative so far.
It's a shame that Florentines have been forced to leave the city center. It's their city and it's been taken away from them. There have been significant repercussions on Florence's social cohesion, as back in the old days, the city center used to be a meeting point for young and old people. It's really bad for our city's sense of community.
The center of Florence has been placed in the hands of large investment funds, and everything is made to support tourism today. Small shops, typical shops, have been forced to shut down. Just a few thousand Florentines still live in the city center these days. Florence has 360,000 inhabitants today, 200,000 less compared to 20 years ago.
Florence is not the only Italian city where large investment groups have been buying properties in historic areas. Rome, Venice and Milan have also been the target of corporate landlords. In 2021, in Berlin, Germany, more than 1 million Berliners supported a campaign to expropriate companies holding 3,000 or more apartments. Italian cities should maybe resort to a similar measure to try to keep local residents in the city centre. Max Civili, Florence.
We attended a press conference held by Yemen's Ministry of Health in Sana'a, where it was declared that the Saudi-imposed blockade is causing a national health crisis by preventing entry of medicines and equipment for kidney failure patients. In the absence of dialysis treatment, approximately 5,000 patients on dialysis are at risk of dying, according to the health ministry.
The Saudi-led coalition targeted the health and medical sector from the very beginning of the war by directly destroying medical facilities, centers, hospitals, and medicine warehouses, and by imposing a blockade on every aspect of life through this siege that is being backed by America in order to control the country's health system.
Khaled Ahmed is one of the patients on dialysis, who is currently getting treatment at a Thota hospital. He said the lack of supplies has prevented him and other patients from receiving the required number of dialysis treatments per week.
We cannot eat much because we are only receiving two dialysis treatments a week instead of the required three treatments. As a result, we can only eat a bare minimum food.
But getting the required three treatments per week for Gayed and the other 5,000 patients like him is a near impossible task these days. This mixed solution, which is used to operate the dialysis machine, is in very short supply. There's only enough for two more weeks.
It's gotten so bad that we have to close down this section simply because we do not have enough supplies to run all of the dialysis machines. If we open this section, we would have no more supplies to treat patients. We've had to make emergency requests to other dialysis clinics to provide us with such equipment. By the end of January, we will be forced to close down because we'll have no more supplies to operate.
Unless the kidney disease center at Thota Hospital is supplied with dialysis filters and the solution needed to operate dialysis machines, they will be forced to shut down by the end of January. If that happens, the lives of approximately 5,000 patients will be at risk. The Yemeni army has repeatedly warned that if the Saudi-imposed blockade is not lifted, it would be forced to take military action. The siege must be ended so that much-needed medicine and other essential supplies can enter the country. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol visited the United Arab Emirates this week to boost trade ties. South Korea is constructing four nuclear reactors for the UAE as President Yoon supports a return to nuclear energy.
Korea has also declared its 2050 carbon neutrality goal. To achieve this goal, we're working to rapidly restore the nuclear power system, which supplies carbon-free electricity, and boost the supply of clean energy, such as renewable energy and hydrogen energy.
President Yoon also seeks to boost weapons exports to the UAE on the heels of a $3.5 billion deal for a South Korean anti-ballistic missile system. This despite a controversial surveillance lapse in South Korea. President Yoon and the South Korean military have been under intense criticism following a recent incursion of five North Korean drones across the border. President Yoon and his wife Sunday visited a detachment of South Korean soldiers stationed in the UAE since 2011. South Korea has become a major arms exporter of fighter jets, tanks, and guided missiles, which have found prominent use in the war in Yemen. South Koreans, however, view such weapons sales with caution.
It's good to sell weapons in terms of earning foreign currency through our exports, but it's not good if those weapons are then actually used in a war.
I know that area has had a lot of conflict and war, so I think selling weapons there will just make the situation worse.
South Korea is now the world's seventh largest arms dealer, with prominent exports to Southeast Asia, Poland, and Saudi Arabia. Frank Smith, Seoul.
On Monday, Eurozone finance ministers marked the occasion of Croatia becoming the 20th member of the Eurogroup. However, Zagreb joins the Euro at a very precarious time for the currency. The big question is, where will the EU get its gas in 2023 and at what price?
While high storage levels and lower demand have helped to bring energy prices down, the crisis is certainly not over.
The EU insists its move to cut out Russian energy over the war in Ukraine has damaged Moscow. But for the first time, there's an acknowledgement of collateral damage.
If you are cutting trade, if you are cutting imports, exports, the bilateral relations with the partner with whom you had a lot of to do with before, then of course there is some negative impact on our side.
Experts say the EU has always been overly dependent on imports of gas, oil and raw materials. It's a reality that won't change.
They all have to be imported in a way that other regions don't. And that means that the European Union is very vulnerable, and it also has to look very carefully where it makes geostrategic alliances.
To obtain essential supplies, the EU will turn a blind eye to crimes committed by the likes of Saudi Arabia and Qatar, according to analysts. Despite enormous economic uncertainty at home, the EU is promising more financial aid for Ukraine.
We will continue to provide strong military, financial, diplomatic and political support to Ukraine and to the Ukrainian people. Together, the EU and its member states have contributed nearly 50 billion euros.
The European Commission has already organised 18 billion euro for Ukraine in 2023. The first tranche is currently being released. The EU will send a further 3 billion euro to Ukraine on Tuesday. As social inequality grows across the bloc, more and more people are asking, can we really afford to keep doing this? Jerome Hughes, Brussels. Stockholm's government has just taken over the rotating presidency of the European Union. It holds the position for the next 6 months and faces many challenges. Amid the conflict in Ukraine, the powers that be in Moscow have been singled out.
This is the peaceful order that the Putin regime now seeks to destroy. But we will defend it here and in Ukraine and everywhere.
Many analysts say the EU has shot itself in the foot by provoking and isolating Russia at Washington's behest. Accommodation, food and energy prices remain extremely high in the EU. The European Parliament has just published results of a survey which shows cost of living is the number one concern for citizens.
Of course, I'm looking to go in and buy my own house at the moment. That's bit difficult to decide. Is it a good time? Is it not a good time?
Is the reliance on food banks is shocking. Even for people in full-time employment, like police officers, teachers.
For instance, Brussels, I think, is the city of trainees, of interns who try to start your career. And, for instance, you can have an internship that is not paid, and what you do?
The EU has sent 50 billion euro to Ukraine during the past 10 months, mostly to provide deadly weapons. Critics say the West wants to feed the arms industry and then make huge profits for Western companies when it finally comes to picking up the pieces.
We are preparing for Ukraine's reconstruction. The international donors platform that we set up with our G7 partners will be up and running this month.
Anti-war activists say many problems could have been averted if Moscow's security concerns had been listened to by NATO and the EU. Tourism industry representatives are asking the European Commission to intervene because in some EU countries, one-third of all rooms being offered by hotels and guest houses are currently being occupied by Ukrainian refugees. There's concern the bloc's tourism sector will be decimated this summer if the issue is not resolved. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The largest biogas plant in Iran is under construction in the city of Mashhad. Biogas is a type of renewable fuel produced after organic waste, such as food scraps and agricultural waste, is decomposed in an oxygen-free environment, producing gases such as methane, which can be converted into electricity. Mashhad biogas plant will generate more than 22,000 megawatts of electricity per year.
At first glance, garbage is all about the expenses associated with its collection, dumping and burying. By using cutting-edge technologies in biogas system, we can generate energy from waste. We will transfer the gases produced in our landfills to the biogas plant and burn them to generate electricity.
Biogas is a mixture of gases produced in landfills, primarily consisting of methane, carbon dioxide,